Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music, Dave.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
You wouldn't be able to do these awful things to me if I weren't still in this chair.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Who's in the box?
Put the gun down, baby.
No, what's in the box?
I said you give me the
what's
gun.
In the box?
Give me the gun.
Wolves have a territorial range of about 300 miles and a kill range of 30. If we're close to their den, and if we're within that radius, then they'll come after us. How can we tell if we're close? We can't.
What in God's name are you talking about?
Your son, Mr. Thorne. The son of the devil.
They're insane.
He must die, Mr. Thorne!
Do not want to go that way.
What's that way?
Officer, sir, you do not want to go that way. We're going to the mall.
Hello, Dexter Morgan.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Everyone's Dave.
Dave, how are you?
I'm all right.
Excellent. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
Awesome.
Excellent. We here are our Dark Discussions podcast, www.darkdiscussions.com. We discuss a topic weekly, generally a film. A genre film, so horror, sci-fi, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, midnight movies, grindhouse, whatnot. And we try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. We do have some house cleaning stuff that we will talk about at the end of the episode. But before we get into any of that, I guess we can discuss some news and such. So anybody have any information or news they wanted to bring up?
I do.
Oh, go, Mike.
Small thing for horror fans. Universal Studios Orlando. Universal Theme Parks, rather. They're opening up a new theme park in the future. Down in Orlando, Florida.
Near future, are we talking like ways out?
Yes. I don't. So, I'm going to guess at least 4 or 5 years. That would be my guess. I don't know if you consider that near. So it's not like next week. So they acquired a whole bunch of land. They're building a new amusement park down there. So they already have Universal Studios and Islands of Adventure. And word leaked that one of the various lands in that new amusement park is likely going to be a Universal Monsters land.
Mm.
So there'll be attractions, theme rides, and a big Dracula's castle, I guess, is what they're...
Wow.
Now,
cool.
That's the good part. You know, the bad part is that all of this is still in the planning phases, and if anything else comes up that they decide to do, that's the first thing that's going to be apparently on the chopping block.
Mm. You mean what the Universal Horror part?
Yes.
Would be the first to be chopped. Gotcha.
So, right. So, if I don't know.
Shit.
Yeah. So, if they come out with a movie called Shit Man and it's and it's a huge success and they decide, well, let's they'll do a Shit Man land instead of a Universal Monsters land.
No, Shit Man.
thank you, Chrissy, for the inspiration.
Now,
you're welcome. Ride the bull.
also.
Well, there might be a water ride, so yeah.
Also, the other thing that would be very unfortunate about the whole situation is that it'll cost $850 by the time it opens to just get a ticket to walk in.
What the? See, that's why I don't go to those places.
It's about, well, for Disney, well, it's not that much. It's about $100 a day for Disney, depending on the time that you get there, so.
Interesting. But either way, yeah, you have to have money to go.
Yeah, that's that's the unfortunate thing. The problem with that is that if you go to the parks, they're always crowded. So, yeah. You know, it's not like they're keeping people away.
Right. All right, so that's interesting news. Universal Monster Land in Universal Theme Park in Orlando. Very well. Any other news anybody wanted to bring up of note? Anything?
The only other thing I heard was that they had finally cast, I guess whoever's going, the new Candyman in the Candyman remake, Buquel, whatever they're doing.
Are they doing that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the Saska sisters were
No, the Candyman is, no, Saska sisters were doing Rabbit. The Candyman is by Jordan Peele.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And if anybody saw Aquaman, the guy who played played Black Manta is the guy who's going to be doing Candyman.
Now, oh, okay, so the Black Manta, that's an African, or I should say black character. Is that correct?
Yeah, because in one of the worst pieces of comic book writing ever, after being in comics for decades, they finally took his helmet off and he said, "Well, why do you think I'm called Black Manta?" I was like, "Oh, God."
Yeah, that's kind of stupid.
Yeah, it was really stupid. But it was a black man. They used a black man, black character, black actor for the part so that nobody got upset.
Gotcha.
Okay. Oh, somebody will get upset anyway.
Yeah, I know.
Especially with social media.
Yep. Everybody's upset about something.
Exactly, yes.
All right, that sounds pretty interesting. Let's see. I know there was new release dates for various films, like the Godzilla versus whatever has been pushed to a different date.
Yeah, that's all next year stuff, so yeah. Something...
Okay, but there was one that this year, the Annabelle film is being pushed up.
Like a week, I think.
Yeah, a week.
Yeah, I doubt it's not April, because they don't even have a title yet.
Gotcha. All right, very well. So that was interesting to see. That's 2019, though, right? The Annabelle film?
In theory, yes.
Okay, right. Let's see. Dark Phoenix, I think, got another poster or trailer or something. I know
Chris Genero
put it up on the Dark Discussion Podcast Facebook group, so join us there.
And I know I'm not a superhero person, but I'm actually really looking forward to Dark Phoenix because I love the X-Men series. So
yeah, there you go. And let's see. That's all I got. Any other news anybody want to bring up? Anything?
I got nothing.
Nope.
All right. We do have an email tonight, and that email is from one of our listeners, Holly Masak, who actually has been doing a podcast recently, and I forget the name of it offhand, but does anybody else know it by chance? I know Dustin Watson of the Horror Carter has been listening to it, and he says it's quite good. Anyone?
Crap.
Me too.
I don't have my Facebook opened.
I know it's horror something. Like, there's all of them. But either way.
Podcast? Is that what you're looking for?
Yes.
Horror Melee.
Horror Melee. That's right. Yep. And that's people can find out wherever podcasts are found. Holly's been doing it for a bit now. But she did send us an email. And once again, thank you, Holly, for your Patreon support as well. And this is what she has to say. She says, "Hey there, DDP crew. I finished listening to your Straw Dog episode this week. And you all did a wonderful job on a tough subject. I had seen this movie maybe 10 years ago, so I gave it another viewing. I'm really glad I did because I appreciate it much more now than I did in my very early 20s. I wanted to expand a bit on your discussion on the theme of masculinity. Neither David nor Amy, the two leads, were happy with what their perceived household roles should be. David is very bookish, with no desire to be the quote-unquote man of the house, while Amy is clearly bored and not interested in being a typical housewife. Not only did it highlight a commentary on the expectations on what a man should act like, but a woman as well. Amy needed to get out of the house and do something. She looks like a caged animal in there, and perhaps she would have thrived more if she weren't beholden to the stereotype of what a woman should be.
Mm.
Christy, I am so glad you're on this podcast for these discussions. I think you all handled talking about the rape scene very well. I as well liked none of these characters. I think Christie summed it up perfectly when she made the distinction between not feeling sorry for Amy, but feeling she did not deserve what happened to her either. It's such a difficult subject to talk about, but I liken Christie's thoughts to any other movie when we may not like a character and then see them get killed. How often do we find ourselves saying, I didn't like that character, so I felt nothing when they died? I also love the explanation of how if Amy were used to being treated that way, that probably feels comfortable and like an addiction to her.
Mm.
I find myself comparing the situation to marital rape. Until pretty recently, it was not considered rape if one spouse forced themselves upon the other. With me being in my early 30s, it's easy for me to see that clearly she was raped, no matter if she seemed to have relented. I'm quite sure women were doing that for far too long in marriages, but I can see how in 1971 this was extremely controversial because the thought surrounding this was so very different. Even today, I know that this would not be a simple conversation. I always look forward to your episodes and the depth at which you all discuss movies. Thanks for doing the tough ones, too. You're all rock stars. Keep up the amazing work. Your friend, Holly.
Thank you, Holly. She's awesome. Yep. Thank you so much, Holly.
And thank you. And by the way, I remember getting in trouble with some people arguing. There was a Game of Thrones episode where
Sansa.
Right, is married and the husband has sex with her, and I was basically, because they were talking about rape, I said, well, but would it have even been considered rape at the time, because she married him, that's what you would have done. And of course people, yeah, from our perspective today it's rape, but would have been rape then, but nobody wanted to hear that because they were seeing it for good reason from the point of view of the not horrible character who was doing it to her. But yeah, it's a tough thing to talk about. My only thing is, and I think you're 100% correct, things would have been so much better if they were comfortable being who they are. My understanding on the director, and I don't understand him that well, is he probably didn't mean for that to be the lesson to take away from it. I think the lesson he wanted was that men should be men and women should be women. That's kind of my understanding of who the director was. I could be completely wrong. My apologies if I am...
offending people again?
Well, not offending people. My apologies. My apologies if I am misunderstanding Peckinpah.
Well, Mike, to be honest, I don't know if it really matters, because the moment something is released to the world, it becomes part of...
And that is true.
Right. And so, technically, one could look at it exactly how Holly mentioned, because, for example... Even if Peckinpah may have meant one thing, if the people did what they wanted to do, which is he be the bookish guy that didn't have to be the, you know, the pound chester that men are supposed to be, and she was, you know, still you know, a homebody, whatever, but went out and did activities and worked around the town or whatever, then maybe they would have both been happy people in the marriage. But again,
or maybe she would have been killed by a golem.
But right, but again, that movie was more than just their marriage and what that was about, because obviously there was outside influences that caused a lot of the problems as well, and that was one of the reasons why they were even in her hometown in the first place, was because he wanted to get away from the stress of the uproarious campus where anti-war things were happening and all that. So,
If you want to know what we're talking about, go watch the original 1971.
Yep.
Movie. I don't know if it's a classic movie, but still controversial movie, Straw Dogs. And then listen to the Dark Discussions episode as we fall all over ourselves trying to
discuss
things we don't know what we're talking about. Okay.
Right. No, I think Holly summed it up pretty good for us. Yeah. No, I think we did quite good, and she said it perfectly. Thanks for doing the tough ones too. And that was a tough one, but it was a good episode. We had a lot to talk about. All right, sounds good. All right, so our new format where we do our house cleaning at the end instead of the beginning. I guess we can begin our topic tonight. So, Eric, what are we going to discuss tonight?
All right, tonight we're talking about a movie currently available on VOD called The Golem.
of life. God has assigned you a calling and you're refusing it.
Inside the Book of Creation and create ourselves a golem.
And the man form in mud shall be engulfed in living fire.
Let there be life.
What have you done?
I have created a golem.
It is a heartless monster, and we must take it back from whence it came before it is too late.
Boy saved me. He took on a handful of men with his bare hands.
That is not a real boy.
Golem is connected to its creator. A golem can evolve.
Merciful, ruthful Lord, we beseech thee. Save this alien child. Send the heavenly cure. And all the people of the earth shall see that thou art called by the name of the Lord. Amen.
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 Besides prayer, there are other things which can be done. He's just a little boy. There's no evil in him.
That's right. It's actually also on Blu-ray. That's how I watched it. It's made the festival circuits in 2018, but was released January 24th everywhere, or at least, you know, wherever, in U.S. box office, whatever. It's directed by the Paz brothers, who also directed the film Jerusalem with a Z. Jerusalem with a Z. We did that episode.
Oh, is that the same guys?
Huh. Same guys. Okay. Yeah. So a couple of Israeli filmmakers, the writer Ariel Cohen, a different writer from their last film. Ariel Cohen is hasn't really done anything else, to my knowledge. And then the actors and actresses, again, I'm not too familiar with most of them, too. But I believe it's pretty much an all-Israeli cast and crew, though I'm not sure where they filmed the movie, but it takes place in Lithuania. So if it was actually filmed in Lithuania, I'm sure there's a lot of Lithuanians that were contracted, or wherever it's made, so be it. But again, most of the folks besides the Paz brothers are unknowns. So I guess go on.
I do want to remind listeners, especially if you're a relatively new listener, because this was about 3 or 4 years ago, go find the Dark Discussions podcast episode on Jerusalem with a big giant Z in the middle. Because that's one of the most fun podcasts we've ever done. And I won't say
had
no.
That
no, you just ruined it.
Bit.
You just ruined it. Oh, right. I was going to have them try to guess who was the one that was drinking absinthe during the recording.
Speaking of that episode, the Paz brothers actually tweeted out our podcast through the Jerusalem movie Twitter
account.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool. Yep, they were happy at what we said about the film, as a matter of fact.
Nice.
Yep. But now they're becoming big shots.
Cool.
Kind of, sort of. I mean, this is still an independent feature, but it could get them some notoriety. The film is by a company called Dread, which I think is a spinoff of Epic Cinema, which Epic is the main company, but I don't know too much details about it. But I know they have a deal, the directors have a deal with Epic to release both Jerusalem and this film. So I guess we can discuss how we heard about this film and how we felt about it, or I should say our thoughts. So let's start with you, Mike.
I don't remember. I heard about it somewhere, reading various posts on Facebook and horror media and so forth, and seeing ads for buy Jerusalem and get the Golem.
I did that for
1995, and act now and we'll throw in this potato peeler or whatever. So I don't know exactly where I first saw that. I like the idea of the Golem. I was a little disappointed in how they used it in the film, but we'll talk about that later. It's the only thing that I was a little disappointed in, but I could kind of guess that they were going to do it anyway, because it is a low budget film. I really like it. It's, where is this film set, Phil?
Lithuania.
All right, so
1673.
Okay, so I knew it was, because it's been plague time, and I knew it was Eastern Europe somewhere. But it's set in a 1673 Jewish community, and I think that was a novel setting. Now, considering they did Jerusalem and the Golem, I'm guessing these are Jewish filmmakers.
Yeah, from Israel.
From Israel. So, it's neat being immersed in a culture that I don't belong to. And there's a lot of little things there that I pick up on, and a lot of things I didn't pick up on. But it's just like any kind of a foreign film, right? That, you know, whether it's Japanese or Norwegian or whatever, because they're all Norwegian, it's neat to see just somebody else's take on what horror is.
They're all Swedes, you mean?
They're all Swedes, yeah. Yeah, wow, I blew that one. All right, never mind. So I liked it a lot. I enjoyed it muchly. My wife enjoyed it, but not as muchly. But we'll talk about more about why, I guess, when we get to the details.
All right, very good. Abe?
I think I heard about this film maybe from just coming across a little bit, a trailer or something like that, or maybe just a little mention of it coming out. And it was kind of on the radar, but not exactly one of the films that was on my wish list for this year. I watched it recently today, just to make sure I kept everything fresh, and I liked it overall. I thought it was well acted, and it was a nice small film. It's got interesting ideas behind it, but it's also, there wasn't anything that really blew me away by it. There were kind of things I kind of expected to happen. They did happen. Aside from one little thing that was a nice little twist, but I think the strongest part is performances. I thought the story was okay, and I could tell it had a very limited budget, but they made do what they were able to, you know, work with, and that's okay. You know, it's really cool sometimes when a film can, you know, make it past like those sort of little weaknesses. Overall, it's good. I'm looking forward. I'm interested in talking about it and kind of delving deeper into it. It was a good film. I think I'll have more to talk about in discussion rather than review. But overall, you know, it was an okay experience.
All right, Chrissy.
I didn't hear about it until you guys started talking about it. You guys were the ones who kind of turned me on it. Phil, I think it was you, said Golem, and I was like, ooh, and my ears perked right up. I really love this film. It was not what I was expecting. I was not expecting a historical film because I hadn't seen the trailers, so I watched the trailer, and I love that Fiddler on the Roof vibe. Even though Fiddler on the Roof took place many, many years later, I think a couple of centuries later.
In a different country, too.
In a different country. It's that same sort of vibe to it, and I really liked it. I think the film itself was extremely solid in terms of story. I, of course, loved the whole grief aspect, and that I can't almost right now think of a better film to exemplify how valuable horror is in talking about the subject of grief, especially deep grief and consuming grief, and grief that leads you to do things you wouldn't normally do. This is going to be very high on my list this year. I thought the acting was phenomenal. I thought it was beautifully shot. I mean, I don't know what else to really say about it critically other than that I thought it was excellent. I liked, you know, this could have been a film where they really beat you on the head with motifs and symbols and, you know, themes and just really, they really could have gone seriously so artsy-fartsy on this, they could have ruined it. And I really didn't feel that with this. I mean, I almost did not take any notes because I was just so loving the way that everything was integrated. So thank you guys for mentioning this to me because I don't think I ever would have discovered it if you guys hadn't said anything. So anyway, that's my thoughts.
All right, very good. I actually heard about it from Mike when Mike mentioned something about it last year in one of our in the news stuff. And so I did some research on it, and I saw that it was by the Paz brothers, and I really liked Jerusalem with a Z, that I put it on my agenda. First time I ever heard of a golem, obviously, it was probably from Dungeons & Dragons, like most kids. So, yeah, I picked it up through that deal that Mike was talking about, $19.99, get the golem and then Jerusalem free. And so I did that more because of Jerusalem, because I always liked that found footage film. And so, yeah, so I saw that it was getting pretty good reviews. I think out of 17 reviews on Rotten Tomato, it has like 94% or something of positive stuff. Yeah, I thought it was a pretty solid film. I do think that there were some issues with the acting, so a little different than what Abe and Chrissy said, because the lead actress had an Iowa accent while her husband spoke with a Eastern European or a Lithuanian or Yiddish accent. And so it was weird to hear people from the same village having different accents. And so that kind of took me out of the film at points. I also felt that there were some issues with the antagonists, because they didn't, I felt that it would have been more interesting if we got some of the point of view of the antagonists as well, especially since we went off to them a couple of times, which felt odd because the rest of the film was through the perspective of this isolated village. And when we went off, it felt weird without having the perspective of the antagonists. But all in all, I felt it was pretty good. I think I may have the same issue as Mike did where they went with the golem. But again, it was probably because of the budgetary reasons they went this way. But all in all, solid film, but definitely more art house. So if you're a horror fan, you should only see it if you're into art house or slow drama horror rather than the kinetic stuff that you would see in sci-fi horror or slashers or whatever. Eric.
I first heard about this, I think, people talking about it on Facebook. I disagree with your categorization, Phil, as this being an art house film. That means something completely different to me personally. I do get your point about the slow burn, though. It is that. I really enjoyed this film. I think Mike just had a nicely phrased way of putting this. I wish I could recall what he just said a few minutes ago. He said something along the lines of, I enjoy being immersed in a culture in which I do not belong. I second that. I find that very interesting. I also seem to just kind of groove on films that have the Jewish mythology in them. I recently revisited The Possession and forgot how awesome that movie is with the Dybbuk box. So,
oh my God, that movie is so good.
Yeah, I tend to enjoy these films. The point that Phil and Mike are making about the golem, I get it. It didn't bother me. personally. I really enjoyed the sequence of events put forth in this movie, in that one choice precipitates another choice, and so on and so forth. And it probably all could have been avoided if one decision at the very beginning had been different. And I enjoy that kind of domino effect. So, yeah, I really enjoyed this film.
Speaking of cultural, being immersed in cultures, if folks were curious about this culture and being done even better than this, would be... last year's Disobedience, starring Rachel Weisz and Rachel McAdams. That's the Jewish London story about the lesbian affair.
I honestly didn't know that that it had anything to do with being Jewish. I just knew about the lesbian part.
Oh, okay,
never got around to seeing it.
Yeah, yeah. It's the suppression and bigotry against lesbianism and versus the cultural conservatism of religious and ethnic group and how it affects people and stuff. Yeah, so it was interesting. The cultural aspect, because I felt it did it really cool. Well. Yeah, yeah.
I'm now actually more interested in watching that movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's Orthodox Jews, so it's very much similar to the 1673 way how Judaism gotcha. Would be, mm-hmm. Yeah. But it takes place in the modern day. All right, so I guess we can do a wiki, Eric.
Wiki. All right. According to IMDb, during an outbreak of a deadly plague, a mystical woman must save her tight-knit Jewish community from foreign invaders. But the entity she conjures to protect them is a far greater evil.
Yeah, sounds good. I would agree with that.
Yeah, it's accurate.
Yeah, it's very accurate. All right, so I have to do my OCD and get that
of course
over, which is
get ready for the history of everybody in this movie.
Oh dear.
Yeah, this. But well, I'll do. I'll just
awesome. I'm going to go smoke a butt. I'll be right back.
it's real quick. It's so this takes place in Lithuania, 1673. Lithuania, a lot of famous Americans where Abe lives. As a matter of fact, a lot of Lithuanian Americans. As a matter of fact, but famous Lithuanians, Johnny Unitas and Butkus. The NFL Hall of Famers. Joe Jurevicius, you remember him? He was good, Eric.
I do remember him.
Yeah. He's one. He'd have
two good games a year and get everybody all excited in fantasy football, and then they'd pick him up and he wouldn't do anything.
That is true. That's true. 650 yards every year, and everybody thought he would eventually hit 1,000. Pink, the singer, is, as a matter of fact. John C. Reilly. One of my heroes from the 1990s, Vytautas Landsbergis, who was the first head of state of the Republic of Lithuania after they gained independence from the evil communist Soviet Union scumbags. I have his
but
biography.
You can go either way on that one.
Well, it's a good, I have his biography.
You don't have any strong feelings.
No, absolutely not. Growing up in this part of the country, Lithuanian Americans, we were very vocal about their hatred to the Soviets, and so I heard it all the time, and I was right with them. Robert Zemeckis, the director, as a matter of fact, and of course, the late, great George R. Romero. Okay. Is it R. Romero?
Yeah.
George R. Yeah, R.
Hey.
Hey, George A. Romero.
Okay. Yeah. And I want to point out if...
But George R. Romero is really enjoying the plug.
If, yes. Martha, they mentioned me. But it's if Johnny Unitas was Lithuanian American, then so is his brother Joe, who was the first person I ever interviewed for the Dark Discussions podcast because he was the director of photography for Night of the Living Dead, speaking of George A. Romero.
That is actually absolutely right. Yep, he is. Hopefully, he's still with us since he was old when you interviewed him. Is a Lithuanian American exactly? Also, Sean Penn, as a matter of fact. Yep, and many others. There's a lot of them. Charles Bronson, Bob Dylan, Lithuanian Americans. There you go.
All right. Now, having gone through the Lithuanian Americans, how about the Lithuanian Canadians?
John Candy is a Lithuanian Canadian. There you go. And that's all I got for Canada. Oh, and there's a lot of hockey players, NHL hockey players of Lithuanian ancestry and from the nation as well. There you go. So I was prepared. I did have the Canadian, John Candy. All right. So with that stated, we can get into our movie before we throw up the spoiler. Anything generally people wanted to bring up about the film that wouldn't be spoilery.
I would just kind of restate that this isn't going to be, you know, this isn't your balls to the wall, scare a minute type of horror film. Okay. It is slowly paced. And it makes me sad that people can't handle that anymore. Because I think it's a really good movie, and I think a lot of people aren't going to like it because it is slow paced, but I don't think that makes it a bad movie. It just makes it a different kind of filmmaking.
Well, but this also only a 90-minute movie, right? Yeah. So this isn't like slow-paced where it's like Mandy that's 2 hours long, you know, and takes a while to get to the point. That this movie is, you get the Gollum within 30 minutes, I'm pretty sure, or is when
you
start
to
get the Gollum.
What about comparing this to a Hammer film?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever seen a Hammer film, so I can't compare.
Well, Eric, there you go for your New Year's resolution episode.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but here's what's interesting, and I'm glad that you asked for like some, you know, summations, Phil, or just, you know, with general thoughts. This is really one of those movies that, like I mentioned earlier, deals with grief and loss in a very specific way. And I think this is one of those films that if you are one of those people who has had a profound, intense personal loss in your life, meaning someone very close to you has died, like you have lost a child or you've lost a parent or you have lost your wife or your husband, and you're widowed, and that really destroyed you. This is the kind of what I like to call emotional horror that is really going to profoundly affect some people and not others. And Eric, I agree with you. It makes me sad that there are people out there who cannot take this kind of film and just accept it for what it is. It's really an exploration of deep grief. But that does not mean that it's not scary. It's going to be terrifying for people who are genuinely afraid of intense loss.
Let's be clear, there is some gore in the film.
There is.
It's not toothless.
Also, there's a feminist element to the film, too.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that was one of the things that I actually questioned. I almost wanted to say, because there was one moment in this film where I was kind of like, okay, this is Lithuania in 1673 in this type of, Jewish community where, oh my God, that woman would have just been
in a lot of trouble for what she did.
And although I am not Jewish and I did not grow up in the Jewish faith and I am not well studied in their social structures, I do know a little bit about how speaking out of turn like that in some of those communities really was just, it just would not have been done.
Christy, I don't even know if it's a Jewish thing as much as a 1673 thing.
Yeah
but I'll also say there's always a history of women or people who go against what their conventions are.
If you look at disobedience, it's also possibly Orthodox Jewish as well. But again, it's not
limited to the Jewish faith.
Absolutely true.
Thank you, Eric. Yes, I would agree. Because in 1673, even Christianity, they didn't, and other religions, it wasn't allowed. And you're right. So thanks for correcting me on that. But the other thing is, I wanted to say that I think that moment was the only moment in the film that I really had a problem with, because it was not believable to me. What little I know about the cultures, the various different religious things and the cultures in the 1600s and 1700s. No way. Like,
well, this is you're talking about the moment of her stepping in the men's meeting.
Oh my God, there would have been
I also think the 7-year discovery would have been hell too.
Well, okay, we're getting into details, so yeah, I think we should throw up the spoiler ahead. Flag. Right.
Yeah.
But my point was, I was just saying,
spoiler flag up. We're going to be discussing details from here on out.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that I think that the problem with that is that, again, it's let's look at this through a modern lens. And there's a place for that, but that was the only moment that I had a problem.
I would state the 7-year discovery too, where he finds out that she was preventing the pregnancy. He would have flipped too.
Well, he did.
Yeah, but it
would have been a lot more intense than that. I'm with Phil.
But anyway,
grounds for big deep shit. Big deep shit. He just walked out on her. Like, he didn't really. I mean, from what little I know of those structured things, structured societies like that, that was a big. I mean, that was a major offense. I mean, women.
Well,
killed for doing stuff like that back
then. Yeah, but not every woman. So, and this is what I was going to say. First of all, there's the meeting that she walks in on. This is after she's created the golem. She's feeling empowered and emboldened, and the rest of the community is kind of...
No, I think this was before, because there was a time where she goes in and her husband forces her out, and this was before the golem.
Yeah, this is when she has the idea of the golem.
Yeah.
Oh, this is where she has? Okay, so maybe I'm getting there. Okay.
Yeah, it was before.
Right. I mean, it's unlikely, but it depends on the community. It depends on the person, and history is filled with exceptions. And we don't tend to tell the stories of the people who are not the exceptions to it. So I'm willing to roll with it. And same thing with the guy. You know, he was already he went from being very loyal to his wife and to basically walking away from her after that, and already considering topping in with another woman.
Well, here's the thing. First of all, he didn't.
No.
He remained faithful. And second of all, he had every right to be pissed. It's not cool that she did not tell him the truth about that. Mm-hmm. He had every right to be angry, and I don't think storming off was unreasonable.
Right. But not every man is going... wife beating may have been much more common then, but mm-hmm. it was not necessarily something that every man did either.
Oh, I didn't even know wife beating we were discussing. Okay, I'm just talking about the reaction.
Let's also think, though, of the exception to the rule in this film. They both lost their son.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is very difficult for... As far as I know, anyway, I have thankfully never been through it because I've never had children. But it is one of the roughest things any marriage can try to survive is the loss of a child.
Oh, absolutely.
The fact that he was so loyal to her. But, you know, there is a hint that the other woman with all the children was attracted to him. And he was kind of like, no, I have to go home and be loyal to my wife. That's just a testament in it to A, how much he loved his wife, and B, how much respect he had for his faith. Because, you know, it was a different, like I said, it's a very strong faith. And once you commit in marriage like that, there is just no room for any kind of infidelity. It is just, it's not done. It was not done. That's like, you know, you go back to kind of like, you think of this was probably a few years later. Well, like
7 years.
Well,
since the death of the child.
Well, and
but
and,
like you have that additional pressure is what I'm saying.
Well, and
is
there's also the fact that his father was a religious leader in the community and was basic and took him aside and said, look, her job is to give you babies and she's not doing her job. You can toss her out and get another one.
Right. It's been 7 years. You can move on with this.
Right. Right. So let me just set it up so people know what we're talking about. Basically, 1673, there's a small village in Lithuania that's a farming village, isolated, like a lot of villages were back in those days. You know, you have your village town center, and then the next town is 7 miles away, and that's a big far area, you know, distance when you don't have cars. And what happens is that the lead character Hanna and her husband are trying to have kids, but Hanna is using some sort of thing to prevent
her. Some kind of herbal spermicide.
Right. Either way, it's just something that she's using medically from the quote unquote witch doctor woman or medical doctor, I assume she is. I'm not sure what she is. Was giving her
raspberries or something in it raspberries was used to like induce abortions. So anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
Right. So preventing her from getting pregnant because she doesn't want any more kids because the loss of the child from drowning from 7 years earlier makes her not want any more kids. Then what's going on is that there's a neighboring town that is Catholics. Since they're Lithuania, it's mostly likely Catholics that are Gentiles, and they're getting killed off by the plague. And the thing is that the Jewish town doesn't trade or anything with them. So as a result, the Jewish town, similar to the movie Black Death.
I was going
to
bring that up, Phil.
Yes, a Christmas movie that we did an episode on. Is isolated to the point where they're not being affected by the disease. And that's pretty much the setup of the film, I guess. And Hannah's sister's about to get married as well. And that is all. All right, so let's discuss it further. So now anybody will basically understand what's going on. So I guess we can discuss the wedding, because pretty much, well, let's learn about Hannah first. Hannah obviously doesn't want kids, so that is kind of a her choice, even though she's not public about it, because as Chrissy said, in those day and ages, the woman doesn't have much right to say anything. So as a result, she's making choices without going public.
It's a role expected of her within that culture.
And she's also learning the Kabbalah because basically it seems where they do religious service where only the men attend, and she hangs out in the basement and listens, and so she begins to learn the Kabbalah, and she also feels that it's not fair that being a woman that she is not able to participate. So there's a lot of aspects about her is that she's more progressive than the regular folk, both male or female, in the town. Am I right to say that?
Yes. Also, I just want to point out that there is a pre-credit scene that depicts. It kind of has a voiceover with somebody talking about the mythology of the golem, and there's just a little precursor thing that shows a scene where a golem had gotten out of control and slaughtered everybody, and there's a little girl who sees that happen. And it was unclear to me the first time I watched this movie. I didn't get it until like halfway through the movie. But there's the older woman in the movie who's
the doctor,
the medicine woman, you know, who's actually providing Hannah with her spermicide, was that little girl in the opening scene that saw that happen.
Well, and I would, if I can just take one moment here, I just want to talk for a couple seconds about the golem and what it is, just for our listeners who may not know. In Jewish folklore, the golem was a protector. It's usually created out of clay or mud, usually using a certain sequence of words or letters written on special paper, and just like they show you in the movie, so the paper is placed in the golem's mouth, and that's how it comes to life. There is a lot of famous folklore regarding this. The most famous is there's a story, and again, this is myth and legend, and where this kind of really came, like sort of moved out of a very esoteric, private Jewish cultural thing and became kind of more in the mainstream, was with a film in the 1920s. I don't remember if it was a silent film or not. I think it was a German, right? It was a German silent film.
Der Golem.
Ah, okay. Yep. And it's considered one of the first, like, horror films or something, isn't it? I think, if I remember reading correctly.
Well, it's one of the oldest surviving horror movies at the very least.
Yeah, and basically it tells the story of this legend or this myth, and as we know, every legend and myth does have a grain of truth in it, that there was a rabbi who in the 16th century, so that would have been, the 1500s? Yeah, who apparently summoned a golem or created a golem in order to protect the Jewish people from being persecuted in Prague. And so I was very impressed with the opening of this film because they did successfully sort of reference that. And actually, if you look at the timeline where the elderly woman, we don't know how old Perla actually is when she reconfronts the golem. But this movie set in 1673. And supposedly this rabbi who summoned this golem to protect the Jewish citizens in Prague, it was the late 1500s. So depending on how old Perla is, that age timeline actually works out beautifully. So I thought that was very well done that they did their research. But anyway, I just wanted to let the listeners know what a golem actually is. It's created out of clay, or mud, and it doesn't have a soul. That's the whole big thing. Supposedly, it doesn't have a soul. And in fact, there is an amazing documentary that everybody can Google on YouTube right now and find called The Golem and Its Influence on Art. And it talks about how our modern fears in the United States and in the developed countries like Europe and whatever about artificial intelligence are actually connected to the original golem myths.
Oh yeah, Frankenstein is
fascinating.
Well, this whole movie, right? Yeah. Because the golem in this movie dressed in stitched up clothing, which was basically a wink to Frankenstein.
Yeah, that was definitely an allusion to Frankenstein, and also the whole idea where if you look at the different golem tales and fabrications over the years, whether they be stories or whether they're in, you know, film, the golem always gets into trouble when it starts, and where it becomes evil is when it starts to question if it actually has an identity, just like Frankenstein. Blade Runner is a fine example of that. That's Best actually world. A modern day golem. So anyway, that documentary is out there for anybody who wants to hear it. It's a great documentary. It's really kind of disturbing, actually. But Blade Runner is a modern golem tale. It's the whole idea of the monster being created and then he doesn't know what he is. He or she doesn't know what he is. And I think in this film, they alluded to that very well in that one moment where the woman is upset and her golem child comes, or she's going to stab herself. Maybe I couldn't figure out if she's going to stab herself.
I thought she was going to try to attack the golem or something.
But you know, the moment I'm talking about, right, Abe?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he goes and hands her the doll because her very first words to him are, "This is the doll that belonged to my son." And it comforted him when he was upset. And so here's the golem boy passing her the doll. And that's very reminiscent of the golem maybe coming into awareness that, am I supposed to be a person? Because it's made very clear throughout the movie that he doesn't feel that, like, you know, when they're sitting at dinner and he just stabs her for no reason.
Right.
Yeah. And, but yet he feels kind of a remorse about that later. So I thought that was sort of interesting. But anyway, I got us off on a tangent. I just wanted to throw that out.
But it also opens the question, is he acting human because she's treating him like that? Right.
That's true. That's interesting.
Yeah. It could be like a case of where the golem is acting what it thinks is the right actions to behave as, you know?
Right. Just like the synthetic ghost creature in Blade Runner Part 2. You remember the girl?
Yeah.
That we thought was alive, and then later on he just finds out that it was a program that was just doing what she knew he wanted, or the program knew he wanted. So that's,
I don't know if it's just like that.
Well, that's true. It's an analogy. It's like an analogy. But basically, it's the same idea, which is that it's a being that is molding itself to how its master wants before it finally decides to do what it wants to do with free will. And usually the free will is usually bad. I
really want to talk to you guys about the end of this movie too, because I need clarification.
All right. But a very interesting thing about this film is the woman is very melancholy, depressed, doesn't want any more children, doesn't like her place in life, you know, being a woman that doesn't have rights and whatnot. And then when the golem comes and she creates the golem and saves the village from the Gentiles who are blaming this village for witchcraft, for the plague, she suddenly becomes jubilant, powerful, happy, sexual, and also what's the word I'm looking for? Not bad, but less judgmental with morals, less moral in a sense, because she's has no issue being.
She's less reserved and more confident.
Yeah. But it's interesting how the movie makes the confidence turn into badness. In other words, power corrupts. Absolutely, and that's what it's. I think it's implying is that power, she gets the power and the confidence, she herself becomes corrupt and evil too.
I think a big part of this is there's consequences, right?
Yeah.
And is that everything has every action has a consequence, and that things will come back around, and really things go. Well, I guess things were inevitably going to go badly for them. When you look at how everything played out.
Well,
but
I'm not trying to cut you off. I just don't know if you're done.
No, I was just sorry. So, and I don't know how much detail we want to get into this, but at this
you can get into point, all you want because we threw up the spoiler.
Right. Okay. So, There's conflict that escalates. There's between the Jews and the Gentiles because of what she does. There's already an existing conflict, but she stirs the pot. And there's some people from I'm not Jewish myself. I have a few members of my family. I have a lot of Jewish friends. There are some elements of the Jewish culture where it's sort of the Jewish fate to be persecuted and just. We keep our heads down, and it'll eventually pass.
Yeah, things will pass over, and that was a case where, you can perfectly understand why Hannah decided to action, because otherwise, just waiting for the stop was not going to happen, because it was clear that the daughter of this man, this group of what group was this? Were they? Did they stay?
The Catholics.
Yeah, I mean
Gentile.
They're
Lithuanians just as the Jews are, but they happen to be Catholics or Gentiles,
if you prefer. Gentiles. So that group, the whole village was on borrowed time because that girl was not going to survive the plague. It was very clear. And even the doctor who was trying to, treat her was only buying time.
Well, and I want to back up to something that Phil said, because he described Hannah's actions as immoral, and I'm not sure, I 100% agree with that because I would say corruption rather than immoral. Yeah, I don't think her intentions were wrong. I think the result was absolutely bad.
That was why I changed it and said,
okay.
Power corrupts absolutely.
Right. Because ultimately, I think she was just trying to protect her village, and then it got out of control.
Right. But it's also liberating.
Well, and Phil's absolutely right about the way that her behavior changed, and that's because, hey, look at this. She was publicly ridiculed as just a woman who would never be able to understand the Kabbalah and create a golem, and she did it. So, you know, fuck you guys. Check it out. I did it. So I can understand how something like that would give her a little spring in her step.
But it's important. You have to have somebody who's a rule breaker to do this in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, if she was Little Miss, you know, Mary well behaved, she's not going to go off and create a golem, you know, when none of the villagers want to do that. Right.
So, yeah.
And she certainly doesn't do it intending to get her son back, but she technically doesn't. But, you know, and this is why I should say, when I went into this, I knew going into it, they were probably going to use a human golem because of the budget. But then once it's the son, it's very obvious that's the only way they could have done it, right? They couldn't have had her having this hulking clay monstrosity. It's, oh, my boy, right? It wouldn't have worked.
Right.
But
the story they wanted to tell, I think it was the right choice.
I think it was the only choice.
But I also, you know, I was also partially bummed to not see a huge hulking golem.
Yeah. Cool.
Which I got up at the beginning, but
in
Which made me question is, like, Was the fact that her mind that constructed the golem to be a small child, or was it just because it had not evolved?
That's a great question, Abe. I don't know.
Because I remember she was reading something mentioning about it the golem evolved, but I wasn't sure exactly what she meant by that. And, you know, rather in terms of its own autonomy. Hey. Oh, go ahead.
No, go.
It's its own autonomy or something else. It wasn't very clear.
Phil, does that disc have a commentary track by any chance?
It does. Yes.
Okay, so cool. So then I might have to pick up that 2-pack myself.
2-pack is dead, Mike.
Yeah, no, he's not. He lives next door to me.
Oh, cool.
Pretending to be a pastor.
or in this case, a Jewish rabbi.
No, pastor.
So I want to get into a little bit what I was discussing earlier about the domino effect, the chain of events, and I really think the first event is the wife deciding that she doesn't want to have any more kids and not telling the husband. So yep. That's been going on the whole time, which starts to make their marriage sour, and then the whole golem thing happens. And because of the decision she made about not having kids, the husband gets pissed and goes to the other woman's house. And I'm pretty sure this was an unintended consequence. I'm pretty sure that Hannah did not understand this could happen. But when she sees them through the window, she gets super pissed because her husband's chatting it up with another woman. And Gollum senses that. And slaughters the woman horribly.
Right. And you know what this made me think of? This made me think of the Forbidden Planet, the Monsters of the Id.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, Mike.
Oh, you should check it out. It's classic science fiction film.
Yeah.
Leslie Nielsen, before he became Leslie Nielsen.
Okay.
When he was still a dramatic actor. And you could see a lot of elements of the classic Star Trek in it.
Hmm.
And
it was scary, too. It was
good. I would recommend watching it.
Oh, yeah, it was one of the best science fiction films of all time, for sure.
Yeah, and Shakespeare totally ripped it off when he wrote The Tempest.
Several hundred years prior.
But
I will say, too, I did – one of the interesting things about the writing of this movie that I thought was kind of cool was that here the golem goes and kills – you know, the target of the woman's up, his quote, mother, for lack of a better term, mother's, you know, hatred. She's upset. So he kills it. He rips out her heart. He, you know, rips off her arm, does all this stuff to her. And the men immediately assume that it was the Gentiles who did it. And Eric, you mentioned before that you really loved the build of the choices.
Right. That's just what I was. I know you stepped away from right for a moment, but that's how I set this up.
Yeah,
and then it continues from there after the woman's slaughter. They assume the Gentiles did it, so then they go to storm the Gentiles, and a couple people get shot, and then the golem makes his appearance in front of a town, and we go from there.
Right, but that's one of the things I wanted to point out when you said that earlier, and then I was just waiting for my opportunity to say it, was that that's actually really solid storytelling.
Oh, absolutely.
Good solid storytelling should be, oh crap, we made this choice and now this led us to another bad choice. And sadly, in a lot of horror movies now, we're kind of seeing that go by the wayside. So to see something like this where it really was stacking and it was very solid stacking was really nice.
And she's understandably, she sees it and she knows what happened, but she, for good reason, doesn't say anything. Because one, she's been trying to get the villagers to take action against the Gentiles to begin with. And the Gentiles have already murdered two people by this point, right?
One.
Well, and here's okay. I stepped away from my mic for a moment. So have we talked about the sister?
Right, Hannah's sister.
Yeah. The only thing we talked about the sister was that the sister was getting married.
Yeah.
And that's when the confrontation begins.
Well, and the confrontation happens at the wedding.
Yeah.
The leader of the Gentiles punches her in the stomach. It turns out she was pregnant, and that ends her pregnancy.
Yeah.
So that's how the whole thing started.
Well, no. What happened was, even before that, Eric, is that during the wedding, the Gentiles punch her, but they also shoot one of the guests.
In the head.
I forgot that part, but yes. Yeah.
Right, yeah. So that's what I'm getting at. There's the pregnancy and there's the... all right, oh, so...
And that's a fair point. She wasn't showing, because obviously it would have been very bad.
I don't think it was public knowledge that she was pregnant.
Yeah, because you're not supposed to, obviously, back in those days.
No, but by this point, Hannah finds out she was after this.
Right.
But by the way, the getting shot in the head is called back later because, and this is again showing the escalation of the violence. So the villagers that after discovering the body, right earlier at this point, what was the Joseph? No, who was the Benjamin? Right,
Benjamin
was the husband.
Yes. Yeah.
So Benjamin goes to and a couple of his homies go up to his father, the rabbi, and say we have to fight. And he shows him he's got a gun. And they can fight back because he's got a gun. Of course, they also have a gun, but mm-hmm. he's got a gun. The Gentiles also have a gun. And mm-hmm. they've got a better gun. and they shot the guest in the head, right? And a nice graphic head explosion. And he says no, but then after they discover, was it Sarah?
Yeah, the sister?
No. Yeah.
The one who died, the one who got killed by the golem.
Oh, yeah. I forget her name.
What was her name?
So yeah. after she's killed, she's the one who's killed by the golem. It's hard to miss her. They go, you know, that's the, oh, they're animals. And they go after them.
They go after the Gentiles. Yep.
And they pull out a gun, and of course, first thing, you know, somebody knocks it out of his hand, because they're farmers, they're not fighters. That was what the father said. What are we going to do, hit them with our books? One of the Gentiles is wrestling with one of his friends, and he picks up the gun, he shoots the Gentile in the head the same way the wedding guest had been shot in the head.
Mm-hmm. Right, yep.
And then... You know, his friend stands up and does like a triumphant, hey, thanks for saving me. And you hear the gunshot and the head Gentile is behind him and shot him, you know, through the chest.
Right.
Later in the film, the head Gentile is killed by the golem in the same way, where the golem like punches his hand through his chest from behind.
Right.
And there's a sound, it's almost the sound of a gunshot. So you're linking the one action leading to the another, even if it's not direct.
Mm-hmm.
As it was before, thematically, you're seeing one action being echoed by the action of another and flipping the sides. What you do to them, they do to you. And the whole idea of the cycle of hatred and violence is being never-ending.
Speaking of the Sarah and her death, when they find the body, the sound effect that that is made when they find the body must be done by a third party, because both Far Cry 5 and this movie use the same sound effect. So
it could be a sound that's used a lot. You know, it could be like a recycled one, like the.
That's what
like,
I mean. Yeah.
Like
the Wilhelm scream.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and this is exactly what Eric's talking about, where one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another.
Somebody wrote a song about that.
They probably did.
One thing leads to another.
And then, of course,
I just totally threw Phil off his game by singing.
Yeah, he's like, what the fuck?
I was just thinking about that monkey song.
Dance with the monkey and yeah. dance.
That's right. Basically what happens is that when they decide to take out the golem, you knew the Gentiles were going to come at that very moment, a little too coincidental. You know, I mean, that's the drama of our suspense of films. And would the golem be destroyed before, and then everybody dies, and everybody dies anyway. But that's besides the point.
I do want to talk about how, like, at the end of the movie, exactly who's dead. Because that was unclear. But
I think everybody died except for the husband.
Except
and
wife. For that girl?
Except for Hannah and her husband, Ben.
Yeah.
And the girl.
Hannah and her husband girl. And the daughter.
Sarah's daughter. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Eric. You said you wanted to discuss the ending because something was unclear.
Yeah, because at the end of the movie, we're looking at pretty much from Hannah's perspective, and she gets knocked out or passes out. I forget which.
Mm-hmm.
So the raid had been going on, and then she passes out, and she wakes up, and everybody's dead. So my question is, were all the villagers killed by the raiders, and the golem killed the raiders, or did the golem kill everybody?
I saw parts where the golem was actually killing villagers, too.
Yeah, it was all happening so quickly, I couldn't
basically
tell.
Basically, this is what happened, is that the Gentiles were coming to raid the village for revenge.
Right.
And also, the head Gentile's daughter finally dies from the plague, and since they were thinking the Jews had cast a witch spell, they blame the Jews for that as well. So they're attacking. The rabbis and the rabbis' apprentices are trying to kill the golem. Right. So the golem Gentiles, takes
them out. That much is clear because they're trying to kill him.
Right. So the Gentile and the Jewish villages are killing each other outside of the temple. And then the golem kills all the rabbis and then comes out and kills everybody else, including the villages and
That's what I was unclear on. I didn't know if he only killed the rabbis in that room because they were actively trying to end him, or if he took out the whole village.
I think he completely went berserk and just started killing everything.
Okay.
That's the come around from the beginning, where the golem in the beginning is killed everybody,
mm-hmm.
including its master. So this is just a flash forward that this golem does exactly the same thing as the golem in the preamble of the movie. Yeah,
cool.
Right, but what's also interesting, Eric, and why I wanted to kind of, you know, bring this up too, was because the end of the film, the daughter of Sarah, who was brutally murdered,
mm-hmm.
has the parchment in her hand.
Right. So it's a cycle that's going to repeat itself.
It's a cycle that's going to repeat itself because, and it's also an interesting cycle that's going to repeat itself because the golem in this film was summoned by a mother who lost her child. Now the implication is the opposite. Now
it would be summoned by a daughter
who lost her mother.
Her mother, yeah.
A child who lost her mother. And I just thought that was so interesting. And yet it wasn't obvious, which was kind of, I mean, it was if you thought about it, but it wasn't like your typical, I'm holding the thing. And
this is really interesting because this is a really well structured, thought out story, but it wasn't occurring to me while I was watching the movie. It's only occurring to me now that we're talking
about it. You know, it's interesting, Chrissy, too, is that even if it's maybe implied that the cycle will be the opposite now, the thing is that the girl's mother was killed by a golem, and yet it's implied that she may make a golem, which was what killed her mother in the first place.
Exactly. Nobody knows that, though, except for maybe Hannah.
Mm-hmm. Or anybody who's ever seen a horror movie before.
Yeah, I'm talking about characters in the movie.
Right, okay. Right. Hannah's the only one that knows that the golem was the murderer.
Well, she finds a scroll. Didn't they hear? I don't know. I don't know. Were they shouting, "The golem, the golem"? I don't know.
No. When Sarah gets killed, they think the Gentiles did it, but Hannah knows the truth. Because
you're talking about the killing. I was talking at the end, they knew it was the golem killing everybody.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
but the thing is that I felt was interesting, too, is that the child, or golem, or whatever it's called, literally doesn't make an appearance. The village doesn't even know it exists until after the Jewish folk head over to kill the Gentiles. And then the golem comes and kills the Gentiles, and that's when they discover. So that's like almost like 30 minutes before the golem appears, and then 45 minutes before the town even knows the golem exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because
And we forgot to mention that the I don't want to call her a witch doctor. That's the wrong word.
Let's just call her
a herbalist.
A herbalist. Okay, that works. The herbalist.
Alchemist.
She knows what's going on the whole time. Yeah. And she's like, look, this is going to end badly. You need to take that scroll out of this thing's mouth. It's not your little boy. It's a monster.
Yeah.
End it. And then when Hannah doesn't do it, she goes to do it herself.
Doesn't do getting well.
Beheaded by the golem in the attic. And that's when the husband is like, all right, that's enough. And decides to enlist his father to kill the golem.
Right.
And I really enjoyed the scene where they tried to kill the golem. I really enjoyed luring him with the violin. That was fucking sweet.
Well, that was very Piper.
Yeah.
Very Frankenstein's monster, too.
Yeah. Yep. That was really nicely done. I would agree with that. And I love also... I just love the whole idea that there was the moral struggle of that was very apparent and very clear whether or not we should do this. Is this the right thing to do? I mean, even when they were like, oh, we got to kill the golem, it was still like, should we really do this?
Mm-hmm.
Like they were constantly struggling with their faith, which I think is very realistic and very true to the way some of these faiths actually were, you know?
I also enjoyed the little detail of when they were doing the ceremony to destroy the golem, that dirt was falling off of him.
Yeah, that was
because he was originally created from dirt. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, and then she finally washes him in a bathtub and gets rid of all the dirt, and underneath is the boy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like almost caked over. It's like a mud man or something.
Right.
Yeah. Let's see what else. So some of the issues I had, like I said, was her accent was like a typical American accent, and then everybody else was.
I didn't even notice.
Yeah, I kind of noticed it, but also the other thing was that I didn't think the Gentile side was built up enough. But again, the movie's in the perspective of the Jewish village anyway, so maybe it's
right. I don't know if it needed to be.
Yeah, and I think that's also, again, we talk about the everything here being cyclical, and this is, you know, one thing causing another, and this is one of the problems that you have with that isolationism sort of cultures like Jews in these countries, which is that they're alienated, so they seclude themselves, which just results in them becoming more alienated, you know, and more distrusted because they're not incorporated in the society, which just ends up in a self-defeating cycle, right? Is that if you don't involve yourself in other communities will start to look at you suspiciously.
Yeah, it's like trying to have this one little plot of land and create that small little world and trying to almost block out everything else.
Right, and you still get that to some degree in every country today, where you have the people who are more, we should reach out to other people, we should trade with other nations, deal with other nations, and people say, fuck the other nations, just shut the doors and deal with ourselves. And the reality is there's a little bit of truth to both. But it's when you go too far in either extreme that you got a problem.
Right. Well, and that's why I brought up Disobedience, that film, because that film shows it really, really well, where the Jewish community in London is so cut off with the rest of the world that one of their own members, who happens to be more progressive, flees to New York City and only comes home when she finds out her father died for the funeral. And there's the hidden stuff begins to come out, and it's interesting, like you said, Mike. It's like she in that movie, the Rachel Weisz character in that movie, is more open, and then the other folk aren't, and Rachel McAdams' character is kind of a tragic character. So again, but I mean, if you haven't seen the film, you don't know what I'm talking about. But it's exactly what you're talking about with the cultural thing and how it happens and stuff.
And even just the whole, you have marriage, you have birth, you have death. I mean, that's literally the whole cycle of life right there, right? I mean, again, cycles are a big part of this film. And from Earth, from the Gollum, from Earth we come, and dust to dust. It's to dust we return.
Yeah,
there's
right.
There's a whole lot of cycling imagery in this whole film.
Right, right. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in this film, because if you want to look at it more than just entertainment, because the whole change of power gives confidence, which then leads to
overconfidence,
which screws up and causes problems, and then everybody goes to hell and whatever. Yeah,
I got to give props to Benjamin. He's a stand-up dude. He's probably the only one in this movie, I don't want to say without fault, but nearly, because man, that other woman was like, yeah, you can get some of this, and he was like, no, still married, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, she was there showing her ankles. But I mean, but I could also understand. But you can. Well, I think the Gentiles were the cartoonish villains. Right. It's, you could almost understand why they did what they did. They were stupid and superstitious. But if you could buy into their mindset, you could understand them thinking that they were not in the wrong here. But I also think as a thing, because they mentioned that the Golem is there for defense. And in a weird way, that's mostly what he does throughout the film. The problem is defense. What is defense, depending on your point of view?
Well, also, it was, in theory, it's for defense, but it's used for intimidation.
Well, but the obvious thing is to defend them against the Gentiles, against the intruders.
Right.
But then he also defends the marriage from an intruder, right? From the person trying to break up the marriage. And then why does he turn on the villagers? Because, well, the villagers tried to destroy him, too, at the end.
Right.
So then he ends up defending himself. And so in some way, the villagers' own fear and fear of the Gollum helps bring about their own destruction.
That's true.
Yeah, although, to be fair, they couldn't really completely understand it, because they found the herbalist stuffed in a freaking bat.
Right.
Well, because the herbalist tried to kill him.
Right.
They don't know that.
But Sarah did nothing wrong, and she just got killed because...
Yes, she did. She tried to break up the marriage.
But that's not anything wrong. The guy said no.
You. It is to her. I imagine if Abe tries to break up your marriage, you go, there's nothing wrong with that. I don't think that's going to be your perspective.
It also seemed like Sarah, who was trying to break up the marriage, I never saw a man around her, so it looked like she was maybe widowed.
Yeah,
that's
why I don't think she was breaking up the marriage. It was There's no such thing as picking up a marriage unless the person says, okay, I'm willing to.
It's from Hannah's point of view, she was breaking up the marriage.
Yes.
She was a threat to the marriage. On some level, she saw her as a threat to the marriage. And this wasn't something new. This bitch had been around the whole time going, look at thine ankles. You know, it's just.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's established very early in the film. And also,
the monsters of the
age. I'm going to reiterate again, I am not an expert in this culture, but and I'm not an expert in what was going on between men and women socially in 1673, but what I can tell you is that a woman who was widowed during that time, no matter the cultural orientation or the faith, it was not, you couldn't survive without a guy back then. Like, it wasn't like today, mm-hmm. where women were like, oh, I can get a job and I can support myself. You know, women
or you get life insurance.
Right. Back then, they had no choice. They had to find another man. And they had to find another man who was going to be steadfast and a provider, which was the number one thing, a provider. Can he give my children a home? Can he keep food on our table? Is he a moral, upstanding man? Does he not go out and drink and cavort with other women? I mean, these were all things that in today's world, we forget those were realities 200 and 300 years ago. And a lot of times during that time frame, I mean, this is discussed in the Scarlet Letter. This is discussed in all of the literature that is out there between the 1600s and like the 1800s. A lot of times the only things women had were their charms. You know, their sex appeal. That was what they had. You know, the expression, and how they could cook. The way to a man's heart is through a stomach. What is she doing for Benjamin? She's cooking for him. That was completely sexual.
I got to interject. One of the best Simpsons was when Marge mistakenly shoplifted and had to go to jail for a couple nights. And Homer says, Marge, I'm going to miss you. It's not just for the sex, but it's also for the food preparation.
Yep. Right on. But those are just things I just wanted to point out because, again, I just feel like we forget that sometimes in our modern sensibilities, we just forget the world was totally different back then. Like, you know, and she wasn't even that sexual with him. All she did was bat her eyelashes because that's all you needed back then, you know?
And also, he had already walked out on his wife, and the town knew that he wasn't living there anymore. So it's not like...
Oh, that's true, too.
You know, so it's not like he was just, you know, walking around the village and she was hitting on him. I mean.
Well, no, she was at the beginning of the movie. She totally was.
She was.
Well, and it had only been a few hours. It's not like he'd been, you know, moved out.
That's true. It was like.
I'm pretty sure that she had her eyes on him for a while. That was my interpretation, at least.
Well, and in the beginning, he calls her daughter Wolfling. And she said, this is the beginning before we even read.
Right.
And he says, hey, Wolfling, whatever. And she says, would you like to, I don't know, come in for something to eat or something like that? And he goes, oh, no, I'm sure Hannah has something at home.
Mm-hmm.
So she was, I mean, and that happened in the first time of the movie.
But that's the typical dating thing where is she really hitting on me or is she just being polite?
Yes, she
you
was.
See what I'm, you see what, no, but she can always back off and say, I wasn't hitting on you. You're insane to think that. I was just
No. Polite. But here's the thing with that, Phil. Back in 1673, there would never have been a question about that. If a woman was talking unsolicited and saying, hey, would you like to stay for dinner to a man, whether he was married or not, that was clearly construed as, I am hitting on you. I want your piece of action in my bed. That was clearly
what she said.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's
it. Not now where I said, hey, Mike and Eric and Phil and Abe, come over for dinner. Oh, my God. If I invited the four of you guys over to my house for dinner in the late 1600s, I would be a whore.
Let's go to the brothel.
That's what I'm seeing. It's different. And we keep trying to interpret these things through our modern sensibilities, and it doesn't work because it was a whole different world back then. You know, back then, you invite a man over for dinner. Oh, yeah, you got designs on him. You don't dare do that. That's what you're really after. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie did it well because it was subtle. Some of these historical films make it really over the top, and I don't necessarily think that that's really would have been more subtle. Yeah.
And to Phil's point, even if you don't think that Sarah was intending to break up the marriage, that's not relevant. At least my perception of what happened is that
Sarah
experienced emotion against Sarah, and the Gollum picked up on it. That was, I thought, what was going on there.
Right, right. Well, yeah, and that's the monsters of the, basically the, in the movie Forbidden Planet, without spoiling it. Monsters can be created through what you, in other words, your
subconscious feelings.
Your subconscious feelings can become reality and become monsters. And that would suck. Oh, it would. And
especially for Eric. Well, actually, no, his hatred of mankind is pretty conscious.
and so that's generally what happened here, where Hannah's id was like, "Ooh, she's stealing my husband, that fucking." And so the Gollum says, "Death to you."
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. You got it.
Yeah. So yeah, that makes sense. Makes sense. All right, let's see. What else? Anything else we missing? Points that we wanted to bring up. Let me ask you this. So it's curious because it's almost like a pro-feminist or pro-woman perspective.
Is it?
At first, because it's showing a woman, you know, fighting the place of the time where, you know, now in today's modern era, we look at it and go, that's ridiculous. And then when she gets the power, she becomes just like anybody else and is corrupted. So it's kind of interesting. So what is that trying to say? Is it trying to say that women should stay in their place? Because if you don't, you'll be corrupted and become evil like the men? Or is it that just a side effect of the story?
I just think it's trying to meddle in things that are beyond one's understanding or control. You know, even the priest who's supposed to be, you know, the rabbi is supposed to be the voice and the leader of the community. We've seen in the prologue, he can't control. He's supposedly the voice and the leader. That rabbi couldn't control the golem and ended up killing the entire village then.
But that's true. But and you're absolutely right. When they create the monster, it corrupts and everybody. But my question is, the first third of the movie is almost like a pro woman's right film, and then the rest of the film is after the pro woman's right is there.
I think everything that's looking at hell. It from a, I think that's what Chrissy was saying. That's less looking at it from a modern sensibility and our own conditioning as to what we expect to see in a film like this, when really it wasn't that it was trying to be necessarily about women's rights. It was just trying to say we need a character who is unorthodox enough that she will try to break all the taboos. Mm-hmm. And I think it was much more about who her character was than about them making a statement about that particular culture.
Excellent. Yes. Excellent point, Mike. Excellent. Okay.
Yeah, good. I would agree, because if you had a typical, quote, woman of the time, I mean, you know, she never would have even thought about like trying to learn what the men learned or reading that, God forbid, reading. I mean, many of those women weren't even allowed to read at all.
I don't know if that would have been the case in a Jewish community, but
no, Well, I don't know either, but I mean, my point is just that if you look at it from whether it was Jewish or not, back then there were many, many women who were not allowed to read. They weren't taught right. to read because that wasn't their thing. Like, they were supposed to have babies, keep the house, keep the chickens. I mean, you know, I'm not being flippant here. I'm just saying that was right. their role. And there was this prevalent... this prevalent sensibility at that time where if you teach a person to read, and Mike, I'm sure you've heard of this. I mean, I did medieval studies in college, and I remember teaching a person to read meant that they would become smart. And this was why in like the Dark Ages, the wealthy people who could read and were educated did not want their serfs to read. Because if their serfs read, the serfs would become knowledgeable. And when you have knowledge, you have power. And then you realize that you are being controlled, and then you might rebel.
Yeah,
right. Well, the same reason
why Martin Luther was such a big deal in the 1500s, because he was like, hey, yo, look at what the church is doing to you. I'm going to show you with right. the 95 Theses. Yeah.
And why you couldn't... teach your slaves to read in the South, and you know, after a certain point, right? Because they started getting, but once they really started getting worried about a slave rebellion, it's like, mm-hmm. okay, we need to crack down a little harder.
yeah,
so yeah. Because
that Turner Rebellion, I think, was the one where they chopped people up.
Knowledge is power.
Yeah,
and if women became educated at that time. Just like if slaves became educated or serfs became educated, then they would figure out that they were being treated poorly.
Right.
And
yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Agree.
So what about the other aspect where they say you shouldn't read the Kabbalah? A woman shouldn't read the Kabbalah because a man can't even understand it, and God doesn't even exist anyway. it's like he's going through the husband, Ben, is going through the steps, you know, just because it's his culture, but he thinks it's all dog shit. And I thought that was interesting when
that was also because he was broken by the fact he lost his son.
Yeah.
Possible, yeah. All right, yeah. You could be.
Yeah, that was my interpretation too. Is that he lost his faith because God took his son away?
Yeah. Okay.
And I also saw that the reason that he was kind of violating his faith because his father was a religious leader in the town. So therefore, this probably isn't a guy who is going to be so quick to violate the community and the social and the religious rules of the time and be like, sure, honey, I'll swipe the Kabbalah for you so you can read it. Like, no. the reason he did that was to appease his wife because they were both in pain.
Mm.
And so that's the only reason he did it. He was desperate to keep her appeased, maybe after their son died. Now, granted, we don't get to see that as viewers of the film, but I kind of got that, you know, the only reason, other than the fact that he loved her so much, that he was allowing her, as head of household, to read the Kabbalah, he knew she was under the floorboards that they're listening. The only reason he allowed all of that, despite his upbringing, was, again, just like you pointed out, because of the loss of their child. And he made an exception, maybe to give her something to do, maybe to keep her healing. Because it's kind of referenced that she's really not a cook, and that she's not a great housekeeper. And that,
right.
So what does she have to offer him? Maybe she really did have nothing when he was like, oh my God, she's going to kill herself if I don't do something. So right, that
by the way, that
what I read into it.
And that also might have been something with why she was able to get away with stuff, right? Is yeah. that, I mean, first of all, let's start with the fact that I might be wrong, but he's the son of the village elder, you know, the rabbi.
Yeah.
So he's probably going to take over when he dies. Is that how that would have worked, or would there have been a vote?
It's possible, yeah.
No idea, Mike.
I am not sure. I am sure there is some listener out there who knows the answer.
Based off of the disobedience film, because, again, the father dies, and that's why she comes back from New York, I think they take a vote, and it's not the son. or relative necessarily. It's all the rabbis and their assistants, and then they vote the new person in. At least that's how it was done in Disobedience.
But yeah, I still think that there was pressure for the son to at least try to take over.
He would be one of the people for sure.
Yeah, he would have been a favored son, right? He would have been in a favored position, so you can usually get away with a little more. Plus, it's the poor woman lost her child, and hasn't been right in the head ever since. So you just kind of look the other way a little bit.
Right. Good point. I mean, other religions, like for the Catholics, they have a group of people and then they just vote for the new pope. For the Muslims, the reason there's the Shiites and the Sunnis is because when Muhammad died, they determined who should take over, and the Shiites said the son, while the Sunnis said it should be the assistant. And that's the so it seems like for religions it's more voting than like kings and queens where it's by blood, but who knows. Let's see. But I like your point, Mike, that the main reason they chose the feminist aspect at the beginning of the film wasn't necessarily to make a point about feminism or today or how women were treated back then, but they needed a character that would go against the grain that would cause the creation of the Golem in the first place.
Right. Well, because it drives me nuts when you see movies that are set in a further past historical time and they throw all these
modern conventions,
modern sensibilities to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now it's one thing when you're dealing, which I guess applies here because it's the Golem. But it's like when you're dealing with Overlord, where it's a fantasy film set in World War II, and you got a black guy in an airborne unit that never would have served there. Yeah. But it's completely different thing. How like every movie they set in, say, the antebellum South, where the white protagonist is always, well, I know I live in the South, but I'm just not cool with that slavery thing.
Yeah. That Phil remembers this. There was an eruption a few years ago, like 3 or 4 years ago, about we can't have things named after Lovecraft or somebody anymore because, Lovecraft was a racist.
And anti-Semitic.
Oh, my God. Or whatever. So was Poe. And so was this person.
So was just about everybody,
Newsflash, everybody was at that time. And 200 years from now, when we all have electronic cars and gas is no longer allowed because it's destroyed the world.
Oh, we're going to be all evil people.
Some dude out there going, well, we hate Philip because you know why? He fucking drove a car with gas.
Oh, you know what? Here's a good example of that.
That is how ridiculous it is. Like, when you put it into that context and you explain that to one of these people, they go, oh, well, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, it was on off rails. Right,
moving on.
No, but I was just thinking there was an episode of Mad Men, which was set in the 1960s or 50s and 60s, where there's two pregnant women at the bar smoking.
Oh yeah.
And we look at it. That was my mother, I'm sure, did that. But now we look at it, it's like, oh my God, you would be a pariah.
Yeah, but they drank too. Pregnant women drank back then. Like, that's just what they did. It's what they did. It was a different time.
Everybody just wants to be sheltered and safe, and everything is be clean for them.
Right. And so, really, back to the movie, Mike's point was that when movies in general, not just this movie, but any movie, is a period piece, but they change it to have modern sensibilities, it makes the film shit, basically, because that's not how it was.
Right. There's no legend of Hannah the Jew who rose up for women's rights everywhere.
This also isn't a documentary, so why don't you relax a little?
That's why Quentin Tarantino always gets attacked for the type of language in like the Django Unchained, for example, and yet technically his point, which is what he defends it by, is he says this is how people spoke and acted back in the day.
Totally.
So why should I change it today?
He shouldn't. And I'm not going to say that Quentin Tarantino is a saint because he's not.
He's not.
But on that particular issue, in that particular movie, he has a point.
Right. Well, he also seems to find a convenient excuse to slip that into any conversation.
That is true.
So it's a little disingenuous.
Also noted. Yes.
It's not like, well, I only use it for that one movie.
Right, right. No, that's true. I mean, he could argue, and he has argued that, well, these are the type of people, they're gangsters or whatever, that's how they're going to speak. But, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Well, that's whatever. Why one of the reasons I loved Mad Men, Mike, because it is one of the only television shows in the recent last 10 years that actually shows people smoking like chimneys and drinking like fish, for real. Because all the other movies and stuff I've seen in the last 10 years set in the 60s and 70s, I'm sorry, dude, my parents smoked. These characters they have that go, oh, it's the 60s, oh, I took one puff of a cigarette and put it out. No, dude, you were smoking all day long, everywhere. You smoked in grocery stores. You smoked in your car. You smoked at your job. Like, these people always, if you were a smoker, you had cigarettes in your hands everywhere you went, all the time. There were ashtrays everywhere. So it cracks me up when I see a movie like that's set in 1972 or something, and like they have one token smoker. I'm like, seriously?
Token smoker.
It's a token smoker. And
the kids will think that means something completely different now.
Yes. And they always think for some reason, they're always smoking outside. I'm like, no, because that smoking outside thing didn't happen until 5 years ago.
Oh, you should see the look on my students' faces when I tell them when I was in kindergarten in arts and crafts, I would make ashtrays.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, for my ashtrays.
And everybody did. Okay. You just assume they smoked.
All right, so let's
get off the rails again.
So, Eric, I have a question for you.
Yes.
To do another
let's
podcast.
Talk about the movie.
Eric.
Listen, I like nice train wreck, Abe. How about you?
Eric, I have a question for you. You do another podcast with your buddy Dan. What's that on?
I do. By the way, I watched this movie with Dan, and he gives it a thumbs up as well. We do a podcast together that's a general interest podcast called The Askancy Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and Google Play.
All right, very good. And Mike, you do a few other podcasts with myself and Eric, and you have a blog, and you just posted something as well.
Well, I finally posted my annual Oscar tradition, which we didn't talk about, which is my putting my year in review thoughts, a lot of which is what we already said in the podcast. But I like having it down where it's easy to reference for myself, even if nobody else reads it. But if you want to read it, it's on Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com. If you want to listen to more of us arguing about stuff that's completely irrelevant to the topic at hand, then you have You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, the Game of Thrones podcast returning in April, and maybe Searching for American Gods, which could be returning soon with the second season of American Gods.
All right, very good. Chrissy, you do things.
I do. I write short dark fiction, and you can follow all of my adventures at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
And Abe, what's our website?
That is darkdiscussions.com. All the episodes we have uploaded so far are free to listen to. There's more on the back burner that is to come. And if you're interested in other things outside of Dark Discussions episodes, if you look on the right-hand side of our main page, you can find links to different blogs and other sites, and some of our friends, too, if you want payment visits, do they have to offer.
That's right. And at the bottom of every page are links to our email, darkdiscussions@aol.com. Also, we have links to iTunes, Stitcher, all those things, wherever podcasts are found. Eric, what else can people find at the top of the page?
Well, that's where you'll find a link to all the past episodes that Abe was referring to. You'll also find a link up there to articles that some people have written, including myself. And on the very front page, front and center, you'll find a link to our Patreon account. Patreon is an online service that lets you support your online artists. If you go there, follow that link, or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions, you can help us out by donating money to offset the cost of producing the podcast. We do have to pay for stuff like hosting fees and new equipment and things like that.
And our hosting.
So if you'd like to help us out, we'd greatly appreciate it. For every $5 a month you choose to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on a show. We take all the submissions and draw them on a quarterly basis. For more details, you can follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions.
All right, very good. Yeah, I think that was it. So let's give our final thoughts on the Golem. So let's start with you, Mike.
Yeah, I did really like this. I will probably end up watching it again. It wasn't expensive to buy if you wanted to get it through streaming. I think it was like $8 or $9. Okay. And I got it through Vudu, which is where I do most of my streaming. So I recommend it if you have any interest in, I would call it folktale horror, right? Kind of more so than art house. Because it's not The Witch, which is both folktale and very art house. This is
mythos, right? Mythos.
Yeah, I would highly recommend it. I would give it a shot.
All right, very good. Yeah, if you like period pieces too, for sure. Abe,
I like this movie. It might not be very high in terms of films that came out this year, but it's still enjoyable. It's a cool little period piece. With good acting, and it does well even with its low budget. As we said, it's a slow burn film, so if you're expecting like a lot of high-octane horror and stuff like that, you're not going to find that here. But it's one that we kind of rewards the patience of its audience. It's overall a good film. I do like folklore horror and stuff like that, and this was a fun discussion too. So, it's available on Amazon. I'm sure there might be a few streaming sites that have it as well.
Everywhere, iTunes, Vudu, Amazon Prime. Well,
then you'll have plenty of places to go if you.
Disc. You get the disc.
You get this too. But probably best to try the movie out first before you decide to buy the disc, just in case. But so if you're interested, go check it out.
Chrissy.
I really enjoyed this film. I'm 100% sure that this is going to make at least my top 10 this year. It is a quiet family horror style drama, meaning it's a dark drama. I didn't really consider this a horror film or a scary film. I think it really does well with depicting the culture. I think it is beautifully shot. I had no problems with the acting. I mean, this is one of those movies where I got to the end and I was like, wow, that was really solid. There was only one tiny thing that bothered me. And especially if you like, as someone referenced, folklore horror or mythological horror, this is definitely for you. This is high on my list. I definitely recommend it. But, if you're looking for a lot of action, this is not it. It's a very quiet film. So...
All right,
well, it gets a little actiony in the last 15 minutes.
Yeah. Well, and I did actually, let me add that, I did appreciate that the denouement and the final scene of the film was not like 40 minutes of freaking action and death. Like, it was 10 minutes like it should have been, and it summed up the story and it was done. Very well done. So,
all right, very good. If you're expecting... a film like the Paz Brothers' first film, Jerusalem with a Z, you will be mistaken. Jerusalem with a Z was kinetic, midnight movie madness, true horror film straight through. And this here is more of a quiet drama with supernatural elements. So it's a completely different type of film. What it does show is that the Paz brothers are fairly talented folk who can adapt their own as well as other people's screenplays in various subgenres of horror. I thought it was a pretty solid film. I didn't like it as much as their first film. Their first film I thought was just goddamn good fun. This was more of a slow burn and drama. So if you're expecting... Like true horror, as Chrissy said, she felt it wasn't really that scary or truly a horror film. It was more of a fable in a sense. But all in all, it's a good film. And if you like period pieces, it should work as well for you. So thumbs up, no matter. Eric?
I like this movie a lot. I've said it before, I'll say it again, I'm a story guy, so having it be a slow burn is fine by me, as long as there's something there, and there is, in my opinion, here. So I don't think I quite liked it as much as Christy, but I think I liked it better than everybody else on the show. So I would definitely give this a recommend. Check it out.
All right, very good. So that's 2019, The Golem, directed by the Paz brothers, as mentioned, and written by Ariel Cohen, starring Hanny Furstenberg as Hannah and Ashaya Gollan as Benjamin. And I guess with that, all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about The Golem. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.